Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the 2018 Home Education Conference, held in Logan, Utah.
Welcome, everybody. I'm glad you're here and interested in teaching some science to your kids. My name is David Reese, and I'm here to talk to you today about teaching science through story and adventure. I wanted to include a picture of me from my childhood, but a natural disaster actually destroyed most of the photographs of me from my childhood. My big sister let me know that I was an ugly child, so it's probably not that much of a loss. But, you know, I didn't have one to include. When I was starting off with middle school, I was living in Hawaii with my family, and I read R is for Rocket. It's an old 1950s sci-fi book. And it had a huge and profound impact on me, especially as I read about the moon and its craters. And this was a topic that really, really got me excited through this story. The story is about these kids who build a friendship with a professor who they just decide to build a rocket and fly to the moon. So they, you know, it gives us the process of how they built their rocket and their journey to the moon. And it really just captivated me. So I started reading everything I could about the moon. And while I was studying the moon, I learned about, of course, craters. And this is the crater known as Kepler, up on your screen here. And Kepler, when the meteor hit this region, it sprayed out material, producing these spray lines. And you can see it as this different color to the background sea, you know, that the impact created. And I read about this exciting experiment that NASA did. NASA basically took this gigantic cannon and loaded in this big aluminum ball and superheated it and then launched it as hard as they could directly at the ground where they had this big sand pit so that they could recreate the process in which a crater forms. And I read that and I said, I bet I could do that. I had a BB gun, and I had aluminum foil, and I had access to rubbing alcohol and matches. So I figured that I could probably pull off the same thing. So I lived in an apartment complex, and I went up to the very top floor, which was the eighth floor, got onto the roof, and I made this little tiny pellet with some aluminum foil. I dipped it in rubbing alcohol. I shoved it down the muzzle of my BB gun. And then for extra measure, I poured some alcohol down the tube of my BB gun. And my plan was to strike a match, light the tip on fire, and then shoot it at the ground. Because I really, you know, expected that I'd be able to superheat my little pellet, and it would hit the ground 8 stories below and make a beautiful replica of a crater. So I light the tip, and I point it down, and the fire just kind of traveled its way all the way up the tube, and I hit fire, and the BB didn't launch, and I basically had to try to figure out how to put out the fire that I started with my BB gun, which was the end of my BB gun. That was the last day it melted. Anyway, it was a cheap plastic one, and it melted. It was gone. Okay, so I was really discouraged, but I didn't give up. I said, well, maybe I can recreate some of the same effects if I just throw a really big rock off the 8th story of this building. So I found the biggest rock I could. I got back up to the 8th, and I chucked it off the roof, and it hit the ground. Now, it rains very frequently in Hawaii, and it had rained just lightly. So when the rock hit the ground, it sprayed this material that was a different shade of brown from everything else, and I got these beautiful ejection lines. I recreated them perfectly. And so one of the ejection lines even hit this old lady and her dog who were standing like 3 feet from where the rock landed. They yelled at me a lot, but I still had a beautiful recreation of a impact crater. Later on, that same year, I started reading Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And if you're wondering, yes, this is a picture of dirt. I realized on my way here that I didn't have a picture of dirt, so I stopped just outside and took a picture of dirt. A lot of people were staring, but I said, yeah, I'm taking a picture of dirt, hashtag the thug life. Yeah, it was pretty exciting. I don't really actually know what hashtag means, so I just heard a student say it. Anyway, this is a picture of dirt. You'll realize why I have this picture of dirt. I was reading Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. I was reading Sherlock Holmes, and I read about how Sherlock Holmes was able to tell where someone had been by the color of dirt on their shoes. So I hopped on my bicycle and I traveled around, all around my small town in Hawaii. It was Mililani in Hawaii, just getting jars of dirt from everywhere and just looking as hard as I could. And every time a guest came over to talk to my mom or, you know, my big sister's boyfriend or anybody came over, I would just look at their shoes and they would wonder why I was staring at their shoes. And I'd try to guess where they were coming from. Now, of course, this is before I realized that the color of dirt depends more on the geology of the general region, and since I lived on an island that formed entirely from a single volcano, that pretty much all the dirt was the same dirt. But I was so excited at the idea that I tried really hard to figure out how to tell where someone had been by the color of dirt on their shoes. Now, the point of this is the fact that every time I had read a story with a little bit of science in it, that story began prompting questions in my mind and urged me on an adventure where I was able to learn a great deal of science for myself. A lot of stories, when sharing a good story, especially with your kids, it's good to give them a question that they can focus on while they read the story. Here's a classic question. If a tree falls in the forest and no one is around to hear it, does it make a sound? Now, this is a good question, okay? But I think there is a more exciting question. If a sound knocks down 83 million trees over 600-mile radius, what is the average atomic weight of iridium found in the Tunguska River Basin? I know this sounds like a weird question, but I think it's a better question to start off our story with. In 1908, people in London noticed that for some reason, after the sun went down, the sky was still bright enough that they could read a newspaper. It was a big mystery. For 2 weeks, after the sun went down, it got nice and dark, you could still read a newspaper outside. There was this haze of light coming from the horizon. And it was a big mystery. Meanwhile, it's the only picture that I had, sorry. In a small outpost in Russia, this is just a trading post, this guy was sitting on his porch in his rocking chair when suddenly he was blasted out of his rocking chair, flew across the room, hit the wall, and said he felt like his shirt was on fire. Now, it took us a long time, but in 1927, this man, I had his name up here, but I forgot to save his name. It was something Russian, so something very complicated. Mr. Awesome Hat Man. Mr. Awesome Hat Man went on an expedition into Siberia to try to figure out what had happened. He was actually the world's leading meteor collector at the time. He had found and analyzed more meteors than anyone else in the world. So he was the leading expert in meteors. And what he found is a gigantic region, a 600-mile region of Siberian forest near the Tunguska River, where the vast majority of the trees had simply been knocked down. And those trees that were still standing had every single branch ripped off of them, all of the bark ripped off of them, and were thoroughly burned. And he was wondering, what could have caused this? What could have led to this particular phenomenon? Okay. By the way, this is the same region today. Right in the middle. This used to be forest. We still don't know exactly what occurred, but the trees refuse to grow back. Around the area, they're recovering quite well. But right in the middle, there's this huge bald spot, which my wife tells me is coming for me someday, but there it is. So you've just heard a story, a true story. What kind of questions does this generate? What kind of adventures can this story take us on? That's an actual question. I'm just wondering. You've heard this story. Do you have any thing you want to find out more about?
It makes me want to know about, how can Sam do that? I didn't realize it could be that powerful. To look more into that kind of stuff.
Okay. So a deeper interest in the concept of sound. Yeah. There's a thing there. Okay, yeah. What's the connecting thread? Very good.
I was wondering about the soil composition of the bald spot. If it's been studied and what sorts of elements are there. Get an idea of what's there or what was there.
Okay. These are some really excellent questions. Let's actually go back a little bit and talk about a few things. There's a reason why I brought up iridium. Iridium, for those of you who are big fans of the periodic table, iridium is an element, but it's one of those special marker elements where the atomic weight of iridium on Earth is different than the atomic weight of iridium found in meteorites. By atomic weight, for those of you who need a little refresher, which is most of us because we don't usually walk around talking about atomic weight. Anyway, yes, my atomic weight is better. I've lost a few neutrons. Anyway, that's the exact tie with atomic weight. If you recall, an atom is composed of protons and neutrons in the nucleus and electrons that orbit that, right? So, but every atom, even though it has every atom of a particular element has the same number of protons, it can have either more or less than average number of neutrons. So the atomic weight is basically the sum of the protons and neutrons in a nucleus. Now, for every element on planet Earth, we've taken the average atomic weight of an element. So we've counted, we gather a whole bunch of atoms of iridium or some other element, and we sort it by its mass, and we say, okay, well, this percentage has more neutrons, this amount has less, and so on and so forth. But when we compare the atomic weight, the average atomic weight of iridium, that element found on Earth, with those of rocks from space, we found that rocks from space have a different average atomic weight. We don't know exactly why, but we know that they do. That, by the way, is the primary piece of evidence for, you've heard the claim that the dinosaurs were wiped out by a meteor. Well, you have, in the fossil record, you have the rocks where all the dinosaurs are, then you have this layer of iridium where the isotope level is wrong, and then after that, you don't have any dinosaurs. So they're thinking, oh, well, something with the wrong amount of iridium slammed into Earth, sprinkled itself all over, and helped wipe out the dinosaurs. So you brought up soil composition. And that actually is this gentleman, Mr. Nice Hat. He never found the rock that he thought caused the Tunguska event. He never found any meteors in the area. But since the discovery of that iridium question, nobody has tested, as far as I know, the soil of this region. So we don't know if possibly the meteor exploded before it ever touched the ground and just sprinkled the region with the composite material. We don't know that yet. But that's something we're trying to find out. Well, no. Another hypothesis is that it could have been a comet. So since comets are actually composed of mostly water, so if it had been a comet hunk that had exploded, then it would. Now, the water that comes from a comet has a different isotope reading, different average atomic weight than water found on Earth, right? It has different ratios of hydrogen, of different types of hydrogen. So we'd be able to tell that, but unfortunately, water would fall down, it would get absorbed by the soil, it would go into the groundwater, and the water cycle will have mixed the water in the region so very thoroughly that it would be hard to detect whether or not it actually was a comet. There's also some other ideas. Now, the idea of a meteor does have precedent. If we jumped down that rabbit hole, in 2013, I don't know if you guys remember, a meteor exploded over Russia. I don't know what it is with Russia, but they attract the things, possibly. But a meteor exploded over a small town in Russia. Okay, the meteor was coming in so fast, it was about the size of the Empire State Building. It was coming in so fast that it built up so much air pressure underneath it that it actually condensed the air below it into a solid wall and exploded. But the sound that came from it, the sound wave that came from that event was so great that it broke all the windows in the town. Every window exploded. Zero fatalities, thankfully. No one was killed. A lot of people were injured. But, no fatalities. So the thought is that a meteor that was much, much, much larger, I think the estimate was 220 million pounds, exploded over Tunguska. That would create enough light that it, and the dust left in the, basically the idea, wow, let me try that sentence again. The dust from the explosion would reflect sunlight over the horizon, which would provide light to London. And the shockwave would easily be enough to cause the damage. But once again, we haven't found any bits of rock. So, that's why we're still pursuing it. That, of course, brings us to sound again. Sound waves are just regions of compressed air followed by regions of rarefied air, meaning less dense air, that travel through space as a wave. Right now, my voice actually pushes air out, hopefully not with enough force that you can smell the onions I had for breakfast. And, the compression wave reaches your ear and is actually able to move your eardrum, that is able to send signals to your brain. Nice, long biological process. But this, of course, created such a pressure wave of air that it was enough pressure to snap trees in half, rip trees out from the ground, kill all the wildlife in the region. Thankfully, this was a completely uninhabited region of Russia. No one lived there, except for the one poor guy who was 40 miles away, by the way. He was 40 miles away, and the pressure wave still knocked him out of his chair and made him feel like his shirt was on fire. So pretty scary stuff. So that brings us to this. I loved these books when I was a kid. Did anyone ever read the Build Your Own Adventure books? Okay, those were great, You're reading a page, Susan approaches the cupboard. Does she use the key to open the cupboard? If yes, go to page 92. If no, go to page 83. And of course, I always chose yes, because the main goal when you're reading those books is to see how many ways you can get the characters killed. And you go straight to that, and then yes, she opens the drawer and a snake comes out and bites off her face, and you're like, yes! And then you have to go back and read more of the story. Just the whole joy of Build Your Own Adventure. This, of course, is one of the best ways to learn science. We like to build fake walls around things when we teach science. We say, you know, this is chemistry, this is physics, this is astronomy, this is biology. None of these things should be touching each other. But the natural way to learn science is the way people have always learned science. You hear a story, you get curious, and you start studying. I unfortunately was not homeschooled. I kind of illegally homeschooled myself, but I'll get to that. But one thing that I adored is, of course, as you've noticed, reading sci-fi. The best sci-fi, by the way, is always like 1950s science fiction, especially to get a kid hooked. I remember, for example, I got in so much trouble for this, but I grew up living near the University of Utah, which has a glorious library, wonderful library with a whole bunch of archives. And this is, of course, after I moved from Hawaii. I lived near the University of Utah. And I read Isaac Asimov's Foundation Trilogy. Don't know if you guys have ever heard of that book, but it's about a man who develops a mathematical and statistical way of predicting the future using statistics. So he'd build up a statistical model of what he thought the future would be like and then have it unfold. And I thought that was a brilliant idea. And you know, I was really good in my pre-algebra class. So I ditched school for a week. I would hop on my bike and say, bye, Mom, going to school. And I'd go to the University of Utah Library. And I snuck down to their basement where they had all these records. And I spent 2 weeks reading all these books, trying to use my pre-algebra skills to build a mathematical way of me being able to predict the future. So the first thing I did is maybe if I study like history of corn yields over the last century. So I went through the library and found all the records on how much corn the U.S. grew. And I just took all the numbers and I built tables and I tried to figure out an equation that would allow me to predict next year's corn yield until Mom found out. And then I, got sent back to public school with me in a lot of trouble. But that is the kind of black hole, educational black hole, although literal black holes are also fun. That's the kind of black hole you want your students, your children to be able to fall into, where they can lose themselves in an idea, in a mathematical idea, like trying to predict the future of corn. Or in the love of a crater, or the pursuit of explosions. This, of course, brings us to another key component in these build your own stories, and it's the idea of danger. A number of years ago, I was showing my students how to make gunpowder, which is, I don't know how they're parents feel about it, but I recommend as a fun activity because it's really hard to make super explosive gunpowder, so they're most likely not going to achieve that, but it's good to make just a little tiny sparkly kind of gunpowder. Anyway, I was doing this with my students, and I forgot, I unconsciously touched my eyebrows when I was telling this story because I lost them at that point, but I forgot that isopropanol, rubbing alcohol, burns clear. When you burn it, its flame doesn't have any color. It's a colorless flame. So I put a few drops to act as an accelerant to start my gunpowder that I hand ground, just using a nice little pestle and mortar and pestle, there we go. Using my own mortar and pestle, hand ground it, showed all the students how to do it. And I put a few drops of rubbing alcohol and I set it on fire. And of course, I'm looking at it going, oh, nothing happened. I must have mixed it wrong. So I pick up the bowl and lift it up nice and close to me because I'm going to carry it back inside. And of course, that's when it goes off. Afterwards, of course, this was all caught on film, and my students adored that moment. And they said, Mr. Reese, we really don't want you to die, but if you can get really close, it's a lot of fun. Now, it sounds kind of mean, but it really is true. It's one of the core things that draws kids to science, the small element of danger. The reason why I love the 1950s sci-fi stories is the 1950s was the golden age of learning science as a kid. Has anyone seen the chemistry sets that they sold back in those days? They would sell you uranium. It was wonderful. They sold you things that just are illegal to own today. And it was glorious. Of course, this was the age where they actually had x-ray machines at the shoe store. They had these little boxes that you could shove your feet into, and you'd look inside it, and it would, putting an x-ray source against your feet to see how well the shoe fit. We were kind of more casual about radioactivity in those days. We've probably gone a little bit to the other extreme, but I don't know. I'm still a man who has way too much uranium rock samples in his garage to talk. Anyway, it's the element of danger. It's the you cannot really allow a student to fully develop a love for science and have them wrapped in bubble wrap at the same time. It's just not going to happen. Now, you want to mitigate danger, okay? You definitely want to mitigate the danger, but at the same time, there has to be a small element of risk. You want it as small as possible, but it's got to be there. It's an ingredient. There's a reason why the vinegar and baking soda volcano is considered the record-breaking, most lamest science experiment, right? Because there's absolutely no risk of you ever getting hurt. It's not going to blow up that hard unless you really push the mixture. That gives me an idea. Never mind. But there's much less of a risk. That brings us to one of my favorite short stories, well, very short paragraph-like things that I've ever read. This is a story of a man who was studying science and his joyous experience with it. This is Ira Remsen. Okay, by the way, this is what you're seeing is the reaction between copper and nitric acid. Yeah, that's nitric acid. Yeah. Funny thing. Well, we'll get there once we can get there. While reading a textbook of chemistry, I came upon the statement, nitric acid acts upon copper. I was getting tired of reading such absurd stuff, and I determined to see what this meant. Copper was more or less familiar to me, for copper scents were still then in use. Kind of hard to find these days, but pure copper scents, I think, ended in 1964. But, pure copper was familiar to him. Anyway, I had seen a bottle marked nitric acid on a table in the doctor's office where I was then doing time. Worked as just a volunteer, as a student. I did not know its particulars, but I was getting on and likely to learn. The spirit of adventure was upon me. Having nitric acid and copper, I had only to learn what the statement nitric acid acts upon copper meant. Then the statement nitric acid acts upon copper would be something more than mere words. All was still. In the interest of knowledge, I was even willing to sacrifice one of the few copper scents then in my possession. I put one of them on the table, opened the bottle marked nitric acid, and poured some of the liquid onto the copper and prepared to make an observation. But what was this wonderful thing which I beheld? The scent was already changed, and it was no small change either. A greenish-blue liquid foamed and fumed over the scent and over the table. The air in the neighborhood of the liquid, in the neighborhood of the performance, became colored dark red. A giant colored cloud arose. This was disagreeable and suffocating. How should I stop this? I tried to get rid of the objectionable mess by picking it up and throwing it out the window, which I had meanwhile opened. I learned another fact. Nitric acid not only acts upon copper, but it acts upon fingers. The pain led to another unpremeditated experiment. I drew my fingers across my trousers, and another fact was discovered. Nitric acid acts upon trousers. Taking everything into consideration, that was the most impressive experiment and, relatively, probably the most costly I have ever performed. It resulted in a desire on my part to learn more about that remarkable kind of action. Plainly, the only way to learn about it was to see its results, to experiment, to work in a laboratory. He kept on reading the idea that nitric acid acts upon copper. And it sounds like a ridiculous statement. It's a useless statement. What does that mean? It wasn't until he had in a completely unsafe container some a penny, which he exposed to nitric acid, that he began to see the reaction and to experience the noxious death cloud that forms right above it, and to really begin to experience what that reaction meant. Then, of course, he picked it up, and it reacted. You know, nitric acid acts upon fingers, and it acts upon trousers. My college professor, my college chemistry professor, one of the proudest things, that he showed this off to every group of students ever. He's so proud of this. He goes, "Do you notice that I'm wearing long pants? Because one day in the laboratory, I didn't wear long pants. And here's the scar." And he would always lift up his pant leg, and you saw the glorious scar, this time from sulfuric acid, that went down his leg from the one time he didn't wear long pants in a lab. But, frankly, from how joyful he was when he was sharing it, I don't think he regretted the scar at all. Anyway, so hearing that story, what kind of adventures are you interested in taking? Now, I wouldn't try touching the penny with the nitric acid. Just don't. But what does that get you interested in? What's in nitric acid? Okay. In fact, that brings us to the wonderful term acid itself. What is an acid? We think of an acid and talk about, you know, we picture, you know, something burning through something else. What is an acid? What makes something an acid? Okay, that's a good question to bring up. What are acids used for? What are they good for? One of the most disappointing, and this is, of course, the value of disappointment, is I had always heard all my friends claim that if you mixed an acid and a base, it exploded. And I was so excited to try it. So I got my hands on a acid. It just said acid. And I said, okay, it's an acid. Okay, and I found a base. Okay, it's a base. I think it was orange juice and bleach. Okay, there's a common acid and base combination, right? You mix them together, you're gonna get an explosion. Okay, an acid mixed with a base makes salt water. Water and a salt. That's what an acid and base do. It actually neutralizes the acid. Okay, if you want to get rid of an acid, you add a base. If you want to get rid of a base, you add an acid. I mixed it together and absolutely nothing happened. And, you know, even those moments are learning moments. Those are beautiful, glorious moments. That is a really good question. And as you can tell from the photograph, this was a long time ago. And I'm racking my brains going, why does this doctor have nitric acid? Maybe if you don't pay your bills? I don't know. I don't know what the nitric acid is for. But it would do the job. It would get rid of the wart. Okay. All right. So I wanted to bring this back around to those stories that had the biggest impact on some of you. What are some science stories that you got exposed to that really pulled you in and made you want to explore more? What are some of your favorite stories?
I'll just go through my son's eyes. War of the Worlds, really. Boom.
Oh, I love that story. That is one of the best stories. And that story has so many stories behind it. That's like Lovell, you can get into the astronomer Lovell, who was convinced about the, found the canals on Mars and wrote so much about them, and the guy had the biggest telescope in the world, so no one could argue with him, and so much sci-fi, like John Carter, the John Carter series, was based on those observations. Some great stuff. Great stuff. Any other?
So it's kind of a different genre of science, but stories that talk about using plants to eat or herbs or medicinal qualities. They'll eat something in the book, and then it makes you wonder, okay, is that really?
Could you actually get away with
it? Where can I go try it? Or using it for healing or something?
Did anyone ever hear that dandelions are edible? And can't walk past a dandelion without feeling the slight temptation to pick it up and shove it in your mouth?
Just the leaves.
Is it just the leaves?
Yes.
I had no idea. I've never tried. I just always walked by going, should I? As a chemist, I generally draw the line at putting things in my mouth, but that doesn't mean I don't feel that inexplicable draw. Anyway, during the alchemy season, you had all the taste, but that is brilliant. I thought I saw another hand. Did you? Oh, I gotta eat a dandelion now. Yeah. Yeah.
What'll happen with it was, they make butter out of cream, and they make cheese out of the rennet and the calcium, all those things. So, we make butter out of cheese, and we play around to make a syrup, and make some things, and make apple pie, and stuff like that. Things that they've done in the book that are interesting.
And just from that idea, there's so much you can go to. There's the history of cheese. There's national cheeses. There's bacteria and how we symbiose with various forms of bacteria to accomplish so many things. That's when I was young I did a lot of nerdy. I was a little bit of a nerd. I might have been a little bit of a nerd. I, of course, don't support drinking alcohol at all. The only time I was even remotely curious was when archaeologists had discovered a sealed pot at the bottom of the Nile River. And the sealed pot that was still completely sealed, none of the river was getting into it. It was a pot of wine from the age of the pharaohs. And it was grown using a bacteria that is extinct. We don't have that anymore. So they were able to pull it out from the bottom of the ocean. And a guy bought it for like $12 million. And there's now in Egypt what is known as Pharaoh's Brew, which is a brand of alcohol based on this rediscovered extinct bacteria. Now, never tried it. But if I were that kind of guy, that would probably be the first one I'd want to try, just because, wow, this is a species of bacteria that vanished from off the face of the earth, that no one could make this alcohol with anymore, that has now suddenly reappeared, and that there it is. Of course, it's still bacteria urine, but it's.
Go ahead. The questions to my mind are, who had that first idea? Like, who decided, let's stick some milk in a cow's stomach and see what happens and eat it?
Yeah. And that course, that brings you down all these new avenues of thinking of the crazy ways in which things have been discovered. Yeah. Yeah, we were doing things and didn't know why they worked. They just did. It's amazing.
This is off topic, but I'm reading some medical dictionary online, and it says they did use nitric acid for warts.
Okay, that deserves a round of applause. That does. Wow, that's like using a nuclear bomb to de-weed your garden. That's, I mean, it'll work, but. Wow. Put on some nitric acid. That. Yes. That one, I had seen the movie, so I decided to skip straight to 3001. But, yeah. Of course, another big influence was, Star Trek, which led us to flip phones and iPads and cell phones and the like. And, of course, pulling that back to learning about the history of how things were discovered. You have, the role of serendipity, like a guy with a really messy desk. I use this with my mom all the time. When my desk was really messy, she'd say, clean it up. And I said, do you know how penicillin was discovered? Okay. The scientist left his lunch out, and he had some petri dishes growing, and, noticed series of events. All I know is that his messy desk led to penicillin, so mom, leave me alone. But yeah, it was my favorite, however, was NutraSweet. Does anyone know the discovery of NutraSweet? Yeah, a man was working on a new additive for rubber to increase the elasticity of rubber. And there was a lab experiment, a lab accident, two most glorious words in the English language. There was a lab accident that led to a big explosion. The man was thrown across the room, but he found himself covered in a white powder. Some had even gotten in his mouth, and he noticed how sweet it tasted. Okay, now, generally tasting your chemistry experiments is a bad idea, but he looked at the series of events that had occurred, wrote down the formula, and that is where we got NutraSweet. A multi-million-dollar idea is born. Of course, my second favorite would be the invention of the microwave oven. An engineer working for the United States government on microwave communications, he goes to a vending machine, buys a Snickers bar, and then walks through the room that is being blasted with microwave radiation. When he gets to the other side of the room, he notices his candy bar is melted. And he's like, wait a second. And that is the invention of the microwave oven. Oddly enough, the man died of cancer. I don't know how, but oddly enough, yeah. But he died also very, very wealthy. So there it is. So stories. My biggest desire was to urge you not to teach science to your kids the way public schools sometimes do it, okay? It is now time for this subject. Here's this subject. Absorb this subject. Move on. I would rather you expose your kids to great stories. Stories can motivate us to learn in a variety of ways. So if it is necessarily time to cover a subject, maybe start with a story. Start with a great question. Find a beautiful, glorious question. This one makes me cry. It's just so beautiful. Okay? If a sound knocks down 83 million trees over a 600-mile radius, what is the average atomic weight of iridium found in the Tunguska River Basin? You know, if you can grab them with interesting questions and interesting stories that can pull you in strange directions, then it gives a great learning opportunity. Please.
Yeah, how do you find these stories? Because it seems like you almost have to have a science background yourself. I was taught it in a way that was traditional and was positive that I just wasn't a science brain and I didn't like science until in college I had a couple of professors who finally helped me realize, no, it was the way it was taught to me. And science is really interesting. But I don't
Okay, good question. For great science stories, of course, ultimately it is about hunting for them. Okay, you do have to be on the lookout. But there are some great books with some great stories that's a fun place to start. I would recommend, for example, not necessarily for your kids to read first, although they do have a child's version of the book, which I would recommend more for your kids reading, but The Disappearing Spoon for chemistry. How about this for the uses of acid? One of the most acid-resistant compounds in the world is gold. There's only one form of acid, which is a mixture of nitric acid, sulfuric acid, and hydrochloric acid, which makes what is known as aqua regia, royal water. Okay, that's what it's called, royal water. Royal water is called royal water because it's the only known acid that can break apart gold. Now, the story is important because you have some Jewish, Polish Nobel Prize winners, and they see the Nazis invading. They have to run across the border, but anything gold they take with them will be seized at the border, and they have their beautiful, big, round, gold Nobel Prizes. So they hand their Nobel Prizes over to their chemist friend and says, hide this, and they run. So the chemist friend is looking around, where do I hide this? He gets a big beaker full of aqua regia, drops in the gold chunks, and has a beaker full of dirty liquid. It made an ugly brown liquid that he just left in a cabinet. The Nazis came by looking for the Nobel Prize. They open it up. Oh, mud water. Okay, no Nobel Prize here. They leave at the war end of the war. He separates out the gold from the aqua regia. They reforge them, and the guys got their Nobel Prizes back, like brand new. that story is from that book, and you'll find a number of other stories, great stories, from that book. Yeah, there's that's a good one for chemistry. For physics, there's a wide number of physics classics. Everyone knows A Brief History of Time. Cosmos is probably one of the most irritating books I've ever read, but that's just, anyway, I didn't enjoy the political slant on that one. For a smart man, Carl Sagan could be stupid sometimes. Anyway, in the area of biology, also from the same author, there's two great works. The first one is called The Hidden Forest. That's not by the same author, but the Hidden Forest is about a man who studies one square inch of a forest for a full year and writes about, not square inch, it was a square meter. It was a meter by a meter by a meter, okay? And writes about all the biological activities that occurred in that 1 meter of forest over the course of 1 year. Incredible book, wonderful book. And it turns scientific processes themselves into a story, which is why it's so great. Another one was The Violinist's Thumb, also by Sam Keen, who wrote The Disappearing Spoon. The Disappearing Spoon, the title, is in reference to gallium. Gallium is a metal. It's the only known metal that is solid up to 87 degrees Fahrenheit. At 87 degrees, it melts. So chemists use it as a prank metal. They make spoons out of it, invite their friends over to make, you know, to have some tea with them, and your friend puts a spoon to stir his tea, and the spoon comes up and it's gone. It's a puddle at the bottom of his tea. You know, it's a great prank. I have a spoon mold and gallium, and it's a lot of fun. You can actually buy a kit for gallium spoons just throughout Amazon. Great activity. And of course, that's the last point that I want to touch on.
The violinist what?
Violinist thumb. Another one about biology. The emphasis is evolutionary biology. So, you know, depending on your comfort with the topic. Once again, I would read all of these books first yourself. One other one, best one on cosmology I ever read, was simply called Bang. Bang. One of the best books, period, I've ever read on science, simply because the authors took a very humble approach to science. And I really just could not recommend that book enough. It's a great book. Alrighty. Let's make our last point here. Back to choose your own adventure. I would tell great stories to your kids, but also select an adventure. Pick a science adventure. Gallium spoons is a great one. Just don't let your kids drink the gallium. However, if they accidentally do, it's just they're going to find out that gallium is a very good laxative. Okay? So if they accidentally take in a little bit, just understand the next week or two they're spending in the bathroom, and it's their room for the next couple of weeks. Okay, but seriously, don't let them drink any. It's not lethal, but it feels like it. I'm not saying that from experience, just read. Anyway, had to clarify with that one. Pick an adventure. Another great adventure, which you need to set up in a careful, responsible, but fun way, is thermite. Heaven love thermite. It's rust and aluminum powder. When you mix the rust and aluminum powder and light it with magnesium, like use a magnesium strip, or simply a 4th of July sparkler. Take the 4th of July sparkler, shove it in the mixture, and run, and enjoy the ensuing chaos. Thermite is used for making spontaneous welds. And basically, the aluminum and the iron in the rust trade places. And the product is liquid iron. You get a river of molten iron. If you have an iron mold underneath it, you can even mold it into a sword or a knife or whatever you want if you have a mold underneath. Okay, thermite, you can make a pound of it, or actually 3 pounds of it, for about $15, once again, from Amazon. Okay? But the point is, look at the stories, find a question, and then try to figure out an adventure that you can have with the concept, okay? Find something that you can build, find something you can go out and do, and as you know, and if there's a small element of risk, look at the risk, evaluate the risk, and you know, if you have a proper means of mitigating the risk, go for it, okay? For example, thermite, beautiful stuff. Don't set it over a pile of ice because it causes the ice to spontaneously explode. So this is a good tip. Thermite doesn't blow up. You just get a river of molten iron from it, unless you're doing it from a tin can, in which case it does explode. That one is from experience.
So read up on the experiment.
Yeah, read up on the experiment first. Okay, so find an adventure. Find something fun that you can do. And mitigate it. A great one, by the way, is also some fun computer simulations. Last word on that. Two programs I'd write down, actually three. The first one, Universe Sandbox 2. This is what happens when you lock up climatologists, astrophysicists, and computer programmers in the same room for a period of 2 years. You get a piece of software that simulates the universe. You can smash comets into the Earth and watch how Earth's climates change. You can turn the black hole into the sun, turn the sun into a black hole and gather ensuing data. Okay, it is a very intense, fun piece of software that you can actually build a lot of astrophysics lessons on. And once again, it's, for now, it's $20 because it's still in beta. They want to release it free for educational purposes when they're actually done with the software. But they've been working on it a long time because they're really perfectionists and they're going all out. But it's a beautiful piece of software. This one is free. This next one is free. It's called AlgoDo. Didn't you see science on the thing? I don't spell. A-L-G-O-D-O-O. I'm pretty sure that's the spelling. AlgoDo. AlgoDo is a two-dimensional physics simulator. And you can build extremely complex machines out of it. And it's a wonderful thing for teaching kids the basics of physics and allowing them just to play. And people have built the most incredibly complex machines in this. With my own students, I hold a once a year challenge where we build a castle and they have to design a machine that destroys the castle. A lot of fun. A good way to introduce basic science principles. Last two. FET, P-H-E-T. FET simulations. Those are some hard computer simulations of everything ranging from biology, chemistry, physics. You'll find some great activities on FET, okay? Last one, Stellarium. Stellar, S-T-A-L-L-A-R-I-U-M. Stellarium, I think. I didn't come here for a spelling bee, Mom. Okay, spelling's hard for me. And my mom's an English teacher. Life was hard growing up. Okay. What? No. I tried, but me and grammar, we don't talk. We don't get each other. Yes, FET and Stellarium is a night sky simulator. It's a great way, you can actually print out current star maps. It's a great way of introducing kids to observational astronomy. Especially if they practice identifying constellations on the software, and then you take them to a dark sky spot and let them see it for real. Thank you so much for being here. I hope I've covered something that's going to be of use to you. I'm sorry that I can't show you my goodbye slide, but thank you.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.